Welcome to the Biodiversity Podcast, an oasis of thought giving space and time to the matters of life around us and how we can support it. Together, we will dive into different topics of biodiversity and hopefully fill your tool belt with the knowledge to make a small difference yourself.
Welcome to the next episode of the Biodiversity Podcast. And this time we've changed the setting a little bit. We find ourselves in the city of Copenhagen at CBS. And CBS this time stands for Copenhagen Business School. We're actually so lucky to have caught the attention of a professor called Maribel Blasco. She's an associate professor at Copenhagen Business School in the Department of Management, Society and Communication. Her research focuses on responsible management and sustainability learning in higher education, particularly within business schools and cross-cultural inquiry. Her work has influenced circular changes at CBS and beyond, as well as teacher training courses and initiatives for international students. Welcome, Professor Blasco.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Also with us today, we have Albina Dioba. She's a postdoctoral researcher at Copenhagen Business School. Her primary research focuses on behavioral economics and sustainability. She explores how insights from behavioral sciences can promote pro-environmental behavior change. Her work is pivotal in understanding the behavioral opportunities for providing environmental sustainability. Welcome, Albina.
Thank you, Bunche.
And alongside me, I have the Dean of the Landscaping Department at Green Academy, Peter Glude.
Hey, Bunche. Nice to be here.
Great. The reason why we're here at CBS, Copenhagen Business School, is because Professor Blasco has worked with a wonderful project. She's been involved in creating a permagarden here at the grounds in Copenhagen. It's quite the undertaking, isn't it? Could you share the inspiration behind the permaculture garden? What will it achieve with the community?
Yeah, thanks, Boncho. I could talk forever about this, but I will share the story of kind of why we started it and kind of where we are right now. So actually, in 2020, our management sort of invited staff to propose ideas for how we could develop the university in various ways. So some of the projects people suggested should be for campus development, others for research and others for education. And I had a very good colleague, Isabel Froes, who can't be with us today, unfortunately. But we started talking about the possibility of creating a garden for learning purposes for our students, a sustainability garden. And originally it was meant to be a roof garden, but we talked with CBS and eventually they gave us a plot of land to use just opposite the St. Vi metro station in the heart of Frederiksberg. So we decided to develop this garden. The vision was to create a sustainability learning hub, a lifelong learning hub, where we could make sustainability issues real to our students. And I've been very inspired by the environmentalist Rachel Carson, who has an idea that we can't protect or we don't protect what we don't love. And so in order for our students and others to be able to protect nature and regenerate nature, we need to have a connection with it. And I carry out research on responsible management education. And one of the key findings, we interview a lot of students in connection with that research. One of the key findings is that students are very alienated from nature, and also that what they learn about sustainability in many of their courses at CBS is highly theoretical. And they have a lot of difficulty making the connection between theory and real change. And we found this very problematic because we have 20,000 students here who are going to become the business leaders of the future. And in order for them to be motivated to change things and to also to change other people's minds, they need to be committed and motivated themselves. And so we found that we were teaching them a lot of theory that they were simply forgetting. And there's a lot of good environmental models and frameworks out there, but unless they're connected to some form of real action in nature, it just doesn't seem to stick. At least that was what we were told by our students. So that was part of our motivation for doing the garden. Albina, you might want to add something. Here.
Yes, of course. Like, I'm joining this team like about a year ago when we have a first lunch event on March 2023. I was lucky to join this inspired two professors that are running this garden. And for me, because back in my career, I was doing mostly theoretical research, but with focus on sustainability. And it was such a great opportunity to connect my theory with something practical. And this also is a great field to test all my hypotheses in practice, if they are working or not. So it's really like benefit not only my pleasure to be in touch with green activities, but also my research ideas.
Brilliant. And you mentioned that you're educating the future leaders. Quite important for them to understand sustainability before they can imply it in their work, before they become leaders for others, decision makers in the end, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, and what we were finding was that a lot of the models and frameworks that we teach at, not only at CBS, but also more widely, are quite out of date compared with what's happening in the real world. So business, it's very hard for businesses to actually keep up with all the requirements and the new standards that they're expected to adhere to. So in a sense, I mean, we also wanted to have a teaching hub where we could sort of focus attention on what's going on and linking to real world practices, and also actually drawing on students' own experiences, because one of the things that we've really realized is a challenge for institutions like our own is that we tend to think that we have the expert knowledge as teachers and not to really bring on board our students' experiences. And what we've realized through talking and researching with our students is that they have a lot of hands-on knowledge from their student jobs and their other experiences that they can bring to learning. And in that way, we can actually use them to help update our curriculum and our vision in how we teach. And so we think that there are a lot of lessons for institutions like our own in actually just pooling everyone's experience rather than relying on quite outdated theories that are just no longer really all that relevant or, you know, pertinent to today's pressing problems, environmental issues.
You mentioned updating the curriculum. I guess that whole process revealed some blind spots in the curriculum that weren't quite addressed.
Yes, I mean, we haven't done it yet. Actually, we're in the process of trying to slowly integrate some sustainability content. What's very typical at business schools and including CBS right now is that we tend to put our sustainability content in electives or other non-mandatory courses. And this kind of sends a signal that it's not really important. So one of the goals is to try and get this type of framework integrated across the curriculum and so that the students meet a consistent message. Otherwise, we end up with what we call the hidden curriculum, where we're teaching about sustainability, but really we're teaching them about something else that's more important. So integrating across the curriculum is really important. And that includes not only teaching, you know, values-based teaching, but also concrete sort of real life experiences that they will remember, that will kind of make an impact on them for years to come.
And of course, if you want to anchor those real life experiences, then you need the physical site
Exactly. And this is exactly what's missing. As you know, we work very much with this mantra, if you like, from environmental education about head, hands and heart. And we're usually only working with head in our large auditoriums. I mean, typically the classes I teach are maybe from 100 to 200 students, and getting them to even engage with their bodies or with the environment is very difficult in that context. So we really, the garden provides a green learning space where you actually remove them from the typical framework of teaching and you can communicate with them in totally other ways. So the teacher-student relationship changes, the students are sort of slightly out of their depth and they become also in some ways more receptive. Not all of them do, but you can see that many of them respond differently when you put them in a different learning environment. And this has been one of the very interesting learnings for us from this project, that we can teach in a totally different, you could say almost more egalitarian or democratic way, where we pool knowledge rather than have this sort of expert-novice relationship, which we don't think is very productive for learning.
Yeah. I could add, like, based on our experience with having event in our garden, so you can see absolutely the big difference when we have the event in for big audience, when everyone were in suits. And if we change the location to the garden, people became more curious, more interested to what they have nearby. So we have a lot of questions. People start joking. So, like, really completely change the atmosphere. And so the growing interest among students and adults, really, really exciting.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, it's also fun. I mean, people have a lot of fun and they get very close very quickly in that kind of learning environment. But there are obviously also challenges. I mean, weather isn't obvious. I mean, we have, and, you know, there are so many challenges to teaching in a green space. We've tried, for example, where it was very windy and no one could hear you. So with large classes, it's very difficult. Papers fly around. You can't put up a PowerPoint that it's raining. I mean, there are so many issues. So one of our goals has been to put up a sustainable greenhouse that can function as a teaching space that is a bit more element proof, if you like, in the garden. And that's probably the next step for us, I think.
So over at Green Academy, we're used to teaching outside in the wind.
We could use some tips.
I'm thinking like Copenhagen, Frederiksberg. That's not the most cheap area in Copenhagen. It's a very fancy area. How big is it to actually get a plot of land for you guys right on Frederiksberg? Isn't that like a...
Yeah.
That wouldn't happen for anyone else, would it?
That's probably true. It's actually one of the great contributions that CBS has made to the project, which is to let us use a piece of land that CBS owns and plans to build on at some point. So actually all our garden activities have been done with the promise that we will be able to deconstruct it and move it elsewhere. So it's a plot that belongs to CBS, and we've been kindly granted permission to do our garden activities there. But yes, that's it's a very expensive piece of land, of course.
Yes, yeah. And also this garden is part of Green Corridor that Frederiksberg Municipality having in city plan. So it's big, like small part of big project that we are carrying on.
Yeah, so maybe Frederiksberg Municipality has a biodiversity strategy. So they have some years to fulfill some biodiversity targets. And we've been collaborating with them from the beginning of the garden because they informed us that CBS owns a lot of land in Frederiksberg, as you point out, and it's difficult for them to reach their target. We are not on board with greening our campus in a more biodiverse friendly way. So that's been our collaboration with them has been kind of also geared towards helping or enabling the campus to be facilitating their green corridor goals and biodiversity goals in the municipality, and they've been very kind to donate seeds and advice to us about native plants and pollinator friendly plants.
And this being the biodiversity podcast, I have to ask, how big was that biodiversity consideration into the whole plan? And yeah, and those seed mixes, were they thought out with indigenous species and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the commune, the local council, has an expert panel of people who have provided information about what plants we should use. And they also have, I think, their own seed mixes, which are carefully planned. I imagine, I'm guessing, with biodiversity ideas in mind. Yeah. So it was, I mean, biodiversity is a big part of this project. So is well-being. I mean, well-being, in permaculture, we have three main ethics: people care, fair share, and earth care. And so well-being in that would be also well-being of animals and plant species, as well as people in the garden or connected with the garden. Yeah.
And about that, what has been the public's response to your garden? The people living there that are not a part of CBS?
There's a large housing association that looks over the garden, and they very much regard the garden as their free wild oasis. And we got in touch with them before we started the garden activities, and we invited them to we had a co-design session for the garden where we invited different stakeholders and a permaculture expert, Katrine Dolleris, from the permaculture organization here in Denmark. And we invited the municipality and we invited various different public stakeholders to come along, including the people who were overlooking the garden. And then they were able to give their input and to explain what the garden area meant to them. And what we learned there was that the garden area was a huge dog walking area. So people didn't really want the place to become too fancy. They were a little bit worried that because it was CBS, we would build some fancy business school garden and then they would lose the freedom to walk their dogs and so on. And that they also use the area as a sort of wild foraging area for blackberries and things like that. And that they just wanted it to be wild. So already there we faced a challenge because CBS wanted it to look nice and the local people wanted it to look wild. And they enjoyed that because there are very few non-manicured spaces in the urban areas right now. And people are missing wildness, actually, it seems. So we had a very good dialogue with them and we decided we will keep the garden wild, and we also invited them to take part in all our activities, including providing organic waste for our compost, and we invited them to pick whatever they wanted from the garden, and also to tell us if there was something they wanted us to plant.
Yes, and they actually participate in our activities, workshops that we are having, and also we are having summer parties, so they are really keen to join us, bring their dogs, kids, and share their insights on what they think about these garden activities. So it's like a very open space, and there some of them provide compost to our bins, so it's nice collaboration.
Yeah, we get a lot of information from them. So when we started working in the garden, we gave our volunteers a sort of etiquette, sheet to be inspired by. And there we encouraged them to communicate with all the dog walkers and the people to inform them what we're doing and to invite them to take part and just generally sort of invite them to interact with the garden. Yeah.
But I could also imagine there were a few misconceptions along the way of what people's idea was. What the garden was going to become, and there was a communication issue. You had to constantly keep them updated on what the plans actually are.
One of our challenges has been that our project has been largely voluntary. CBS put an initial sum of money in for the structures in the garden, but the rest of the activities are so voluntary. And so our funding, we were kindly donated some funding by Frederiksberg Fonden. And we use that to buy plants and hold activities. But for example, signs, we haven't yet got any signage in the garden, and that's a really important next step, so people are informed about what's going on.
About miscommunication, maybe it's like commonly questions that we are asked about. Do we have some harvest to pick up from our activity? So maybe we are planning to sell these vegetables. So because we are based on CBS business school, so a lot of people maybe expect some finance yield from our activity. So not the same as what we are expecting from this.
Yeah.
So this is, I think, for me, greatest misunderstanding. But when people get involved in this activity, they understand what it's about.
Yeah, and you mentioned yields, because yield here would be quite different than the standard business model of the farmer getting the crops. Yield could also be the soft values, like the urban dweller's well-being and the sense of bringing nature close to the city and using the urban spaces in a different way and thinking about sustainability in a different way.
Right, yes. And I mean, in a business school, yield is one thing, pretty much it's profit, right? And this has also been, we use the garden very much as a teaching metaphor for our students to open up the idea of yield as being community or joy or aesthetic pleasure or biodiversity or other aspects. And to me, the idea of yield in permaculture, that it's much broader than the way we normally think about it, that is a threshold concept, as we call it, and that means a concept that kind of, in a sense, once you've learned it, you can't really go back and think differently. So I think it's an extremely powerful idea that can sort of counteract some of the conventional ways we think about profit or project outcomes in conventional business.
Yeah. And aesthetics, that is what we landscapers do, Peter.
Yeah.
How do we incorporate classic landscaping aesthetics into a permagarden, two things that would normally clash?
Well, it's all about not one or another. We need to find the common way into this. So that's very important when we talk about aesthetics into it. So we need to take the traditions we already have in Denmark and try to take these new knowledge coming about permaculture that actually is just the old Danish way to do gardening. So if we go 400 years back, so we need to incorporate that knowledge we had then with the way things has been the last many years. So it's very important to find the common ground in it.
And finding common ground is not easy, because we all come with our different skill set. And actually, it was quite serendipitous that we got to talk to you guys. So maybe we should try and envision ways to cooperate in the future. The business model together with the old school craft of landscaping. That could create a business model on its own, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I think that's an excellent idea. We need to work very interdisciplinary to make these things happen and to network as much as possible with like-minded institutions. So that's our goal. We contact everybody we possibly can. So we are just reaching out right now as widely as possible.
And that's a part of your research as well, isn't it?
I mean, yes, at the moment we're writing a book, actually, you know, trying to document the process of studying Permahaven as a sort of a, not a template, but a kind of a tentative roadmap for other institutions, especially business schools who might want to integrate an urban garden. Because it's increasingly the case that, I mean, it used to be very much the case that it was only sort of more life sciences or oriented, or, you know, people like you guys who are doing landscape architecture who would work with gardens. But, you know, the models behind permaculture and permaculture as a metaphor has, you know, extensive kind of ramifications beyond just the physical or life sciences. And that's been, you know, what we think.
Yes, I really like the idea of these levels of knowledge that you shared today with us on our panel session on Green Business Forum. I think it's really nice to mix this knowledge, this level of knowledge, in different way. So, of course, life science and social science should be collaborate.
So what would the future of Permahaven, the Permagarden, what would that be?
That's a really good question. And of course, we are, in a sense, also at the mercy of institutional changes and decisions. So, I mean, right now we're in a very exciting phase because after really 4 years of operating almost under the radar institutionally or based on our own volunteer power and so on, we have now been given an institutional home at the Lifelong Learning Unit here at CBS. And that means that we have a little more legitimacy and also some resources in terms of hours and funding. And we are collaborating with Station, the student organization, which is on an intergenerational lifelong learning project. So the garden will be used as a pilot project to bring together different community members and pooling knowledge and sharing knowledge about sustainability, or actually regeneration, because we prefer the term regenerative than sustainable. Because if we sustain what we're doing right now, we're not going to get very far. We need to actually work on healing the soil and the earth.
And we have to be careful about those terms, because we could easily step into the greenwashing stigma.
Yeah.
And that could have legal repercussions in the world we live in.
Absolutely.
So how do we avoid that? How do we commercialize? How do we advertise our work without stepping onto the greenwashing stigma?
Yeah, we've been discussing this a lot in our team. And also we've had questions about this from people who we interact with and who we tell about the garden. And we've come to the conclusion, actually, it's very pragmatic, that greenwashing is, of course, a problem. CBS, in some ways, has been very glad to brand the garden as part of our sustainability initiatives. And at the same time, we've really been struggling in some ways to function within the institution, partly for governance reasons, because it's not easy to place a garden within a business school. It has no natural home. For us in the team, we reached the pragmatic conclusion that actually all advertising was good advertising, because the more people that knew about permaculture, even if it was a greenwashing exercise, the better. So we decided that we wouldn't regard it as a problem, and we actually think that greenwashing can be a driver of change as well, because the motivation is to market or brand something that actually spreads the word. So it can also, I mean, of course, it's an issue and it's a huge challenge and problem for organizations and for the green agenda, but it can be a valuable driver too, we think.
Yeah, it can also be like a creation of a narrative to get the startup story. So greenwashing can be part of that narrative in good and bad.
Yeah, and I think we need to think inclusively when we do this type of project. We can't say, oh, we are the ones doing the good work and there's the cynical people over there. If we do that, we won't be able to advance our project. We need to have everybody on board. And so we don't need alienating discourses that differentiate between the climate good guys and the climate bad guys.
Yes. I would like to come back to your previous question, how we see our Permahaven in 2 years. Because it's very connected with what we are saying. So this is a really great place for collaboration. We grew for this year from one volunteer to 80 volunteers for now. So a lot of projects hear about us and provide some offers to collaborate. For example, we have now EU Bitter Green that they are working on developing source separating system about wastewater. So they provide human-derived fertilizer. And we are planning to have some event in next month in our Permahaven to apply this fertilizer and maybe even run to some experiment to analyze which fertilizer is working. So it's also our work to influence people, just to show there are different approaches to be sustainable, to be regenerative in a way. So this is our way to maybe also deal with greenwashing. There are some nice ideas and more people know about this, so we can reach our goal faster.
What advice would you give to the other institutions that take up on creating such a garden? I mean, for us at Green Academy, it's completely natural. We have plenty of gardens, but they have a very practical purpose.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, it's not as natural in a business school, but how should they tackle this? What are the things you could have thought of beforehand, something that mm-hmm. you should have thought of?
Okay, I can share only my experience because I have already joined team that already studies garden. But what I find inspiring is like you need to collaborate with people that you like. So I think it's all about people that like-minded. So they support your ideas, your goal, and then all struggles that you are facing. So for me, it's like a big team, nice team to work with.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I mean, I think we have faced so many practical challenges and institutional challenges, but the energy we have gotten from the goodwill, we think about resources very much in monetary terms generally, that we can't do anything without money and so on. But actually, we realized when working with this at CBS that there are so many people willing to invest time and energy. And that gave us such a good energy back that it sort of, in a sense, kept the project going. So go where the good energy is. Don't be put off if things don't work out, and regard every step as a victory, every small step, because it's going to be a very challenging process. But I think also one of the key things is that we didn't ask ourselves the question, what is a garden, when we started the project? And institutionally, in like a business school, a garden is a very strange creature because it spans so many different, it doesn't like belong naturally anywhere. So finding an institutional home, I think, is really important before a project like this gets going. Otherwise, you could spend a lot of energy trying to figure out who should own it. And that's important in an institution like this.
And I guess you constantly have to promote the value of it to yeah. people that don't quite understand the
exactly.
concept and how it's beneficial.
Yeah, so part of this has been about learning to speak the right languages. So, for example, if we're talking to our management, we need to show the value for the branding of CBS. I mean, that's not a cynical move. That's simply learning to speak the language of the people that can move things at different level from us. And for us, that's been a learning curve, but it's important. And then for the students, the garden will mean something else. So we need to learn how to explain the value for them, and the same for the public and so on. So it's almost a translation process that you have to engage in.
If we have to bring it down to the personal level, how would the normal person interested in a garden start a permagarden? What's rule number one?
Yeah, I mean, the rule number one is observe and interact. Typically when we do gardening, we come in with a bunch of ideas. We dig up an area, we plant what we think is nice or we fancy having in there, and we pay zero attention almost to the context and what is growing there already or naturally, or to observing the sun and the, you know, maybe there are frost pockets or something. So permaculture is very much based on observing what's happening, what's already growing, what does that tell you about the soil, where should you plant things for optimal practicality. So in permaculture operates with a zone system. So for example, your house is in the center, maybe, and zone one would be the things you use on an everyday basis, like herbs, so they should be close to the house. And working outwards, you would have maybe chickens a bit further away. If they're too far away, you won't be taking care of them properly and so on. And then the furthest zone is the foraging or the wild zone. So there is a zoning area. So permaculture has a lot of tools for organizing the way that you plan a garden. But observe and interact and see what's there. Spend a bit of time seeing nature, and then you can see what your soil is doing and what might thrive and what might not thrive.
Get your fingers dirty.
Exactly, but mostly don't do it. Actually, mostly don't do that until you've sat and watched it for a while.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Okay. Brilliant. Good advice. Well, Maribel, Albina, Pida, how do we keep this impact of this corporation? Maybe you guys should come and visit us at Green Academy.
We would love to do that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sounds really amazing. Thank you.
Very inspiring to talk to you.
Thank you for your participation. It's been a pleasure. Thank you guys for listening. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to another edition of the Biodiversity Podcast. This program is supported by Green Academy Aarhus. Join us next time, and remember, you are already a part of the change we all need.